everybody. I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic. Sure is good to be here in ILAA and here at the zoo. I really like this venue, frankly, you know. Let's clap for that, huh? For those of you who are listening to this tape, we're at the San Diego Zoo having dinner at the Treetop Cafe or something like that. But the gorillas are surrounding us and the birds and the aviary are around us, and we had a little chance to see some animals a little earlier with some hooting and hollering back in the back that I didn't quite understand. But, you know, the ILAA means a lot to me. And I think that Mike's story tells us something that we read in the big book, that is, no matter how far down we have gone, and then we can get back. We can get back and beyond back. And we come to these rooms with no hope, and we leave with hope. And we leave here with lessons on how to learn, how to live life, and how to act and how to react. And so I want to tell you how much I appreciate ILAA and Alcoholics Anonymous. It's done amazing things for me. Since the first time I was at an ILAA meeting in Boston, which was probably about 1988 or 1989. I became a county bar president, and then I became a member of the Board of Governors, where I met Mike, and we instituted the LAP program for the State Bar of California. We worked on that and worked on the legislation and worked on the implementation of it because, you see, we were way behind times in California. The other bar was one of the first groups to form and to work with others that had alcohol problems. But as far as having an LAP, all of the other states were way ahead of us and we were way behind. So we didn't get that instituted until about 2001. But Mike and I worked together to also put in the alternative discipline program that he's talking about to get these people shuffled over to a drug court. We wanted a true diversion program, but didn't get it, as he explained to you. And so while it was very interesting because, you see, let me step back a second. So since ILAA, the county bar president and the state bar board of governors, which was an elected position, and then the state bar presidency, over 200,000 lawyers in the state of California, and I was their president. But it wasn't always that way. You know, it wasn't always good. It started out a lot differently than that, and I want to take you there. For a moment. So back in high school, I grew up in a family that didn't drink. There was no drinking in my family. There was no alcoholism in my family. If there was any alcohol to be had at Thanksgiving or something like that, it was 1/5 or 1/4 of Mogan David wine passed around a whole family of 13 brothers and sisters that were my aunts and uncles. And that was it. That was the extent of any alcohol in our family. So somehow I got lucky enough to catch this little disease and be the first. In high school, you know, I was a true boy. I don't know what girls are like because I'm not a girl, but I do know what boys are like, and that I would see myself as a true adventurous young man, and I wanted every adventure that a young boy could get. And so when we got to the point where alcohol was introduced to me, this was going to be an adventure. I had never tried it before. I was 18 years old. It was after a football game in high school, and somebody had taken their father's liquor cabinet and poured everything together and came out with a couple of bottles of booze, and there we went out in the orange groves in California and drank that booze. And in that first night, I experienced everything that I had experienced later in my career of becoming an alcoholic. I destroyed property. I destroyed relationships. I blacked out and couldn't remember what I had done. I was disappointed. I was guilty. I was sick. I was physically destroyed. All those things in the very first night. And it should have given me a warning. And it probably did give me a warning because I did not like drunks. You know, I had girlfriends that had fathers that were drunks. And I can remember going over to their house, and especially this one girlfriend, and her father would sit there in the easy chair drinking his Hams beer. And he'd be just messed up. And he would tell you're going to do this. And you should be doing that. And I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand it. I thought he was a disgrace. He was disgusting, you know. And I never, ever would want to be like that guy. Never, ever. And I became that guy. And so I didn't drink for several years after the high school formative years. I would drive another fella around or other people around, and they would drink. Oh, I do have one exception, one slight exception. But most of the time I would drive other people around and they would drink. And I went through college. I got in a minor scrape with drugs. Minor at the time wasn't very minor to me because I got kicked out of the school I was going to. And for, when you go from where I was at, I was a high school president of my senior class. I was probably third in line as far as grade point average. I was a basketball player and the most valuable tennis player, and recruited to go to Harvard University, Harvard College, and I didn't do that. I applied to two schools for college and got scholarships to both, and went to a small Southern Baptist school in Siloam Springs, Arkansas, because my mother decided I needed a good Christian education because she didn't like the people I was running around with. And so I capitulated and resented it, and due to my resentment, I left that school at their request after about a year and a half. But when I left that school, you see, I was kind of right in the middle of all the semesters and quarters and everything like that, and contrary to what Mike's all about, I did not want to go to Vietnam, thank you very much. And so let Mike go, man, I don't know, you know. But so I went from the student deferment to a 1A right away, and it was trouble in River City and Riverside at the time. But I got to stay in school, and drinking became interesting to me. I had a girlfriend whose parents were Navy people, and career Navy people tended to drink a bit, and at least they did, and they introduced me to scotch. Now, I did not like scotch very much, but scotch had a certain taste, you kind of acquire a taste for it, you know, after a while, and it was kind of neat because when you get around the adults and the parents and stuff like that, you can get loaded, and they not only condone it, they push it to you, you know, here, take some more. And it's not like drugs or something that, you know, everybody hates that and condemns it. It was just, here, let me pour you a drink. Here, let me pour you a drink. And so that got to be quite an enjoyable time. And I found myself that I would drink at parties and that sort of thing. And is there anybody here, just one hand go up, it would amaze me, is there anybody here who does not dance better after drinking? Oh, Eli, you liar. Okay. All right. Well, Eli got us, says he doesn't, but I don't believe it. But So I would drink at parties and that sort of thing, but it was a weekend or a kind of a intermittent off and on type of thing. And when I drank to get drunk. I did not drink to savor the taste of alcohol or isn't that Heineken wonderful, you know, cold like that, or I didn't care if it was cold, man, you know? And so then things happened, and life progressed, and I met my wife, Cindy. And by the way, before I forget this, and I will forget it if I don't say it now, Tuesday is our anniversary, and we will be married 42 years.
Wow.
And you'll wonder how crazy she is when you hear the story. You do know how crazy she is, yeah. So I met Cindy, and I remember that when I was about 21 or 22 years old, we were coming back from Yosemite. We had visited Yosemite and had a nice time there, and we were coming back, and we stopped at the bottom of this hill that we call the Grapevine here. It's between Los Angeles and the Central Valley of California, and we stopped at the base of the Grapevine at a little cafe and didn't have anything to do while we were getting hamburgers, while the hamburgers were coming. And so there was a little jukebox thing where you put quarters in or whatever and select your song and that sort of thing. And right next to it, there were these sheets of paper, right? Little sheets. They were kind of like this. They were about that wide and a little longer than that, maybe this long. And they had 20 questions on it. And so I wasn't doing anything, and so I decided to spend the time looking at these 20 questions. And so I was, you know, they're just yes or no questions, so yes, no, whatever it might be. And I went through these 20 questions, and I got down to the bottom of it, and it said, if you've answered yes to any one of these questions, there's a sign you might be an alcoholic. Do you dance better when you're drunk? Come on. Okay. If you've answered yes to two of these questions, there's a good indicator. I forget the exact language. A good indicator that you are an alcoholic. Oh, come on, man. And if you've answered yes to three or more of these questions, you are definitely an alcoholic. All right, I don't know if you guys cuss on these tapes, but I call bullshit on that one. You know, I thought this was total AA propaganda, because it's right on the thing, AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? Right there on the sheet, it says that. But it also says that this is the test that Johns Hopkins University uses to determine whether a patient is an alcoholic. And it gave it instant credibility. And so I had to look at that test in all seriousness and retake it because I had obviously misinterpreted the question. And so for the longest time, true story, for the longest time I didn't drink alone. Because I would have been an alcoholic. Right? It's true. So I went on in that kind of mode, not drinking alone, and drinking on occasion, drinking at parties and that sort of thing, and always probably out of control, to at least some extent, and many blackouts, probably from the beginning. And people would start to ask me things like, don't you think you should cut back a little bit? Don't you think you should take it easy? How about if you don't drink at this party? Do you remember how you put that footprint on the ceiling? What footprint? Oh, no, I don't remember that. And how you broke the coffee table and how you did this and how you did that. And no, I didn't remember those things. And but, you know, Cindy, we got married and we had three sons. We have three sons now. They're all adults. One's a patrolman, a cop. One's a journeyman electrician, and one's a foreman. None of them wanted to be lawyers. They thought it was too much work. The cop wanted adrenaline, and so he gets it. But Cindy and I got married, and I was in this house. Now, the two houses are so different, the two homes. There's my house where I grew up, where nothing was ever good enough for my mother. You know, I mean, it didn't matter if I was the, I was the student body president in my college. I was the valedictorian in my graduating class. But was that good enough? Oh no, man, that wasn't good enough. So, you know, there was that one, which there's no alcohol in that house, none, zero, unless I brought it home. But you go to Cindy's house. Now, Cindy's house was all right. Her parents drank. Everybody around them drank. And so I was very comfortable at Cindy's house, you know, and it was a great time. And we would do things like knock the Christmas tree over in the middle of the, you know, Christmas party, or the spaghetti would fly across the room, or, you know, you wake up to greyhounds in the morning, right? So all of those things were happening. But, you know, tell a little bit about Cindy's story. Just before I met her, her father died at 47 years old from alcoholism. And it's a tragic story in itself, you know. And so she had that memory, you know, that was always lingering with her. Her stepfather was a wild, wild, crazy dude. And younger than her mother, but also definitely an alcoholic. Her husband was certainly becoming an alcoholic, if he wasn't. And I think probably I drank alone by then, so I had probably turned the corner somewhere. But things got to the point where they were getting a little darker for me. And the questions were getting to be asked more often. Don't you think you should cut back? Don't you think you should stop? You know, why do you do this to yourself? Why are you doing that to everybody else? And my reaction would always be, why don't you mind your own business? This is not your problem. This is my problem. I'm not messing with you. I'm not affecting you. You know, leave me alone. I mean, I've had all these, my own wife, huh? She's got the phone ringing over here. Okay, so. What's that guy's name, anyway? So where was I?
Sorry, Joe.
Where was I in this story? Who can help me out? Nobody was listening, so nobody cares. Okay, so.
We're asking you to slow down.
Oh yeah, slowing down. So I would do that, and I was thinking about stopping. And you know, when I was a kid, I was very religious, and I got baptized at an early age, and I was very dedicated to God for a few years. And as I was getting more and more into alcoholism, and more into the struggle with alcoholism, I was becoming more and more abandoned by my God. I was living in a darker, darker place, and my prayers went unanswered. So I would pray and pray and pray to be relieved from this obsession. And it was becoming more of an obsession. I would quit for a couple of weeks, I would quit for a month, I would quit for a day. But it was becoming worse and worse and worse. And I had turned the corner somewhere along the line, and it was becoming more of an obsession. And so my prayers went unanswered, and I would pray in the morning for relief from this obsession. I would be crying at night in self-pity, one more time drunk, and unable to stop. And so I was getting to the point where it was becoming really important to me to not drink, to stop drinking, because my life was just totally out of control. And as far as my appearances go, how I would appear to you, my fellow lawyers, my colleagues, other people, I'd be fine, you know, I'd be fine. I wouldn't drink during the day. I'd be able to handle myself. I was moving up in the county bar, in the ranks of the lawyers, and that sort of thing, but inside, I was in turmoil and terror and all alone, isolated in a dark, dark place. And so I promised myself, I had this one case one time, and I promised myself that if I won this case, which was a pretty big case, I was going to buy myself a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. Because I always wanted a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. I told you I was an adventurous little boy. I always wanted a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. And I promised myself, if I got myself a Harley-Davidson motorcycle, I will never drink again. And so I didn't. And that's the end of the story. Thank you. All right, so I'll make something up. So I got this Harley-Davidson motorcycle, and I didn't drink. And about 2 weeks later, after I got it, I thought, you know, I've really screwed this up. I had wrong thinking, man, wrong thinking. You know, there's no reason not to ever drink again just because you got a Harley-Davidson, right? I mean, as long as you don't drink on the day you ride the motorcycle, all should be good, right? Right. So I decided to commit myself to never drink on any day that I rode the motorcycle. So that lasted a couple weeks, and so I decided, man, your thinking's way off, dude. And you got to rethink this, you know, because it's obviously wrong thinking that you can't drink on any day you ride the Harley. You can drink after you ride the Harley, right? And so, hey, that's okay. And so I did that. And then this is how I ended up riding the Harley. I had the helmet off, tied to the motorcycle crash bars, bucket up. And my fifth of gin in the bucket. And that's how I rode that Harley. And that thing was heavy enough, so if you're going down the road, you can just let go of the handlebars, reach back here, uncork that baby, and hit it, and put it back. And that's how I rode the Harley. And so I got involved with what you might call a lower class of friends, you know, lower companionship and all of that. The motorcycle people that I was riding with weren't in your, you know, weren't wearing suits usually. And so I got involved in these, it was this few people, and one of these days I was going to go over to this fella's house, Brian's house, and I was going to go riding motorcycles with Brian. And I told Cindy, as I was required to do, because she would insist, you know, what are you doing? Where are you going? Well, who are you going to be with? You're not going to be drinking, are you? You're not going to be drinking, are you? You're not going to drink this time, are you? You won't be drinking, will you? Not on that motorcycle. You won't be drinking. No, Cindy, I promise you, I will not be drinking. I'm not drinking this time. I'm just going over to Brian's. We're going to go for a little putt, and I'll be back, and no drinking. And I don't know about you, I'm pretty sure I know about you, but I don't absolutely know about you, but I know that I meant that from the very bottom of my soul. That when I would give an oath not to drink that day, I meant I will not drink today. I promise you I won't drink today. And there's nobody could take that away from me. I meant that with every ounce of my body and mind and soul. And then I couldn't keep the promise. I went over to Brian's house that day, I remember, and I was waiting for him, and I don't know about you, but maybe I do know about you. No. I get anxious. If I'm waiting for somebody, I get anxious. I get nervous. And there's a fella here named Larry, and Larry always calls it diseased. And so I became diseased with Brian not showing up where we were supposed to meet. And I knew how I could get rid of the anxiety. I knew how I could get rid of that disease. And so I went down to the liquor store and I bought myself a half pint. I came back to Brian's house and sat on my motorcycle and drank that half pint. And Brian didn't show up, and Brian didn't show up, and Brian didn't show up. And I got anxious. And so I went back to that liquor store and got myself some more liquor, and Brian never did show up. And so I was on my way home, and I was going down the freeway. Excuse me, and it was a kind of a misty day, you know. And so I'm riding the motorcycle, and somebody ticked me off that was in a lane next to me. And so I'm going to show him, right? I got my big old motorcycle. He's just in a van. And so I'm going to show him. So I took that motorcycle, and I swung all the way from the slow lane across a couple lanes and cut in front of him, man, show him off, you know, what's going on. And that back tire of mine just slid out from under me, and now we're going, boy. Across three lanes of traffic, get it upright, three lanes of traffic going that way, upright, three lanes of traffic going that way. And I'm thinking, am I going to crash in the freeway with all these cars, or am I going to crash in this median strip where there's dirt? And just dirt. And I was thinking, well, you know, when you're a kid and you're riding your bicycle, right, you go in that dirt and you slam on the brakes and skid sideways, everything is cool, right? That's what I'll try and do. Sally, don't laugh. So I'm headed for the median strip. I want you to understand, though, that it wasn't, my thought wasn't about saving my life then. My thought was, it's finally over. I don't know why I get emotional at this right now, but the idea was, it was finally over. My life was over. The struggle was over. This is going to be it, man. It's going to be ended. A relief. Death was going to be a relief. And obviously, it didn't happen that way. And so they took me to the hospital, and I was all broken up. Broke every bone down this side twice, including the collarbone, all the ribs, bruised heart, crushed lung, concussion. Went to ICU, and the doctor, I'll never forget, was on my side. What a great guy. He's in there and he's telling me, Jim, you know, I've got to inflate this lung, but you've been drinking too much. I can't give you any anesthetic. I got to stick this scalpel in and stick a tube in there and reinflate the lung, or else you'll die. And I said, I'll die? And he said, yeah, you'll die. I said, well, what are we waiting for? And so he stabbed me with that thing and stuck it in. And then he gave Cindy a lecture about how could she allow me to go out so drunk on a motorcycle. Wasn't he a great guy? Really understood alcoholism. But anyway, so I spent some time in ICU, and then I spent some time in a hospital bed at home. And this is where lawyers kind of come in. Up until that point in time, Cindy has an uncle that abandoned me in his drinking. He taught me how to drink Boilermakers, and we had lots of adventures together, lots of fun together, and then he abandoned me and went to AA, can you imagine? And left me out there all alone as an alcoholic. And so he was gone to me. And I went, and I was in this hospital bed all broken up. And if you want to know what kind of person Cindy is, you know, Cindy gets me set up in this bed at home, and so she puts the mattress up, and she puts all the pillows under the mattress, you know, so it's kind of slanted up like that, and she's really kind to me, and she's sweet, even though I had put her through all of this stuff. And if you've ever had that many broken ribs, you know, you can't even cough, you know. That's about as much of a cough as you can get. So I'm propped up on those pillows and stuff, and she goes to work. Well, I got no strength, man. And so you kind of go down a little bit. And so I down, further down, further down, further. By the time she gets home, I'm in this fetal position at the base of the bed. And what does she do when she comes in? She laughs. She thought it was hilarious, man. I was so mad. Anyway, so the one thing that lawyers became involved at that point in time, as oddly as it may be, there was a guy I used to work for, and he came over to visit me at home and while I was in this hospital bed, and he said, Jim, do you think maybe you're an alcoholic? I don't know, maybe. You know, I was definitely an alcoholic, but maybe. And he said, well, you know, I got a DUI, and I had to go to these Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I heard somebody say that if you go to 90 meetings in 90 days, you got a good chance of staying sober. And so if you want, I'll take you to 90 meetings in 90 days. And this is a guy who would never say he was an alcoholic, I guarantee it, man. So I said, well, okay, I'll try that. And so as soon as I could get out of the hospital bed, I started going to meetings with him. Now, this is the first meeting that we go to. We're sitting around in this circle behind in a storeroom behind a church, and they're going around talking about their periods of sobriety, right? And so it's, I'm Joe, I got 14 years. I'm Frank, alcoholic, I got 10 years. I'm Bob, alcoholic, I got 6 months. I'm Mary, alcoholic, I got 2 years. So it's coming around, you know, keep away from me. I don't want to be saying I got 2 hours, you know, and but that's how it's coming. And so this is Bob right here, and it's going circling around this way. And so it's alcoholic, alcoholic, alcoholic. And when it gets to Bob, he says, hi, I'm Bob, and Jim's an alcoholic. Pretty good, huh? So Bob lasted about 3 or 4 meetings, and then he couldn't hang anymore. He had something else he had to do, but I kind of caught to the program, and I went to 40 meetings in 40 days, and it was so strange. It was so strange. The obsession left. It lifted. I didn't have to stop at the liquor store. I could keep my wallet in my pocket and my credit cards, and I didn't have to use them at the liquor store. I didn't have to go between liquor stores so that nobody would, you know, recognize me as having bought that fifth, you know, earlier yesterday or whatever. And I didn't have to borrow money in case I left my money at home because I needed to stop there. I could go home. I could go straight home from work without stopping at the liquor store, you know. And I got well. I got well in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I knew that I could drink like a gentleman again. And I did. I did. I drank like a gentleman for a good 20 minutes or so. I don't think I ever actually truthfully drank like a gentleman again. Because I remember the day I went to buy liquor again, July 1st of that year, 1986, I went down to the liquor store, and by the time I got back to our house, it's kind of ranch style house, so the living room's in the front, you drive up the driveway to the garage, and I found myself parked in the driveway, bent down below the dashboard, hitting that fifth of gin in my drinking like a gentleman. And so that's how that worked for me. And so 17 days later, I was playing tennis with one of my sons. It was a great day. It was a great day. We were playing tennis and had a good time. And we were at the local high school, and it got to be early evening, late afternoon, and I decided to buy myself some liquor on the way home. And this particular time, I remember, it was a little smooth little whiskey called Wild Turkey. And I took that home and I drank it at home with no intentions whatsoever of going out. I wasn't very much of an outside bar drinker or anything like that. But so I had every intention of staying home, but a guy called me up and told me he needed help. And he had pancreatic cancer, and he was in terrible pain, and he needed to get to a hospital, and the ambulance wouldn't come and pick him up anymore because he didn't have any money and he had used up all of his whatever benefits he had so that he couldn't, so that he could get an ambulance. And I was his only chance and his only hope, and I needed to come and get him. And I told him, no, man, I'm too drunk. I've been drinking. I can't come and get you. Oh, man, and he begged and pleaded and begged and pleaded. And finally, if you're like me, you get that recognition that you're omnipotent and you can do these things and you can drive, you know, okay. I mean, you can make it, right? And so I decided I was going to go help him. Because after all, I was the only person who could. And so just about that time, Cindy came home from wherever she was. And she said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to help this fella. You know, he needs to get down to the hospital. He's in terrible pain, and I'm his only, you know, help. And that's what I'm going to do. And she said, you can't go anywhere. You're too drunk. You can't go anywhere. Are you crazy? I said, I gotta go, man. I gotta go help this guy. And she said, no. Listen, my dad died an alcoholic, you know, died from drinking. And my stepfather, the guy I told you was crazy, died in a barroom brawl at 39 years old from drinking. And my uncles are alcoholics. So my grandfather's an alcoholic, and now I'm married to a drunk. If you go out that door, you just keep going, we're done. And so I said, well, okay. I got to go. I'll see you. And so I left. And I got about 2 miles away and crossed over a median strip and hit a lady head on. And I thought I'd killed a family. I remember the headlights in front of me. I remember the aftermath and having my feet trapped in the floorboards from the bent metal. I remember seeing her Mustang. It looked like a truck. I mean, like a train had gone straight over the top of that Mustang. The coroner came to the scene. The emergency vehicles had it blocked off from top to bottom. Some guy at the scene had me call my wife and tell her that I was in an accident. This was about 3 months after the motorcycle. So she had her drive. She had her sister drive her to the accident scene, but she couldn't get out. She was hysterical on the floorboards of the car when she saw the damage. And so her sister came and checked on me, and then they took me off to the jail. And they took the lady that was in the car, not a family, but just a lady. I shouldn't say just a lady, but a lady in the car. I took her to the hospital, saved her life. And fixed her up as best they could. Later on, I pled to a felony and spent 6 months plus in jail. And her life was good. I mean, it was good in the sense that she was alive. Beyond that, it was bad. She was very broken up. Permanent, forever and ever and ever injuries. Everything had been taken away from me at that point in time. All of my excuses, nothing had worked. My aunts praying over me in tongues, my going down to the front at the altar at Easter sunrise service, my rededication to the God of my understanding. The psychologist that I had gone to, you know, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And we never once talked about alcohol. All of that stuff was no good. And the idea of stopping drinking, the idea of treatment programs suddenly became available because everything else was gone. The practice was gone. The family was gone. The career was gone. Maybe this woman's life is gone. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And so I went into a treatment center. But this was only after about 2 or 3 months of maintenance drinking. You know, Now, that's how I thought of it. For 3 years, I swear, I thought of this as maintenance drinking. I imagined myself taking a drink or two a day and just kind of smoothing out the edges. But I didn't remember blacking out, getting kicked out of bars, passing out on bars, in bar rooms, and yelling at my kids in blackouts. And it was not a good 2 months. It was not maintenance drinking, but that's how I thought of it. That's how I saw myself at that point in time. So I went into the treatment program, and thankfully, I haven't had a drink since. And so it's been since September 1 of 1986. And what they did in that treatment program was take me through the first 5 steps. And so I had to rewrite that first step, I don't know how many times, and talk about how I was powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable. And then through the 5th step, where we had shared with another person, these things that had come up in the inventory in the 4th and that sort of thing. And when I got out of that treatment center, I went home and I felt safe in the treatment center. I was surrounded by alcoholics and people in getting into recovery, and we shared our experience, strength, and hope, and we shared our hearts, what we share in these rooms, we shared our hearts. And I went home, and there's that pressure, that same old pressure, man. Here's this loving wife who really is happy to see me home. Kids, 3 kids climbing on me, And welcome home, Jim, a banner up there. And so I gave my wife a hug, and I can remember the sun was going down in the kitchen window. And I said, I gotta go. And she thought that I meant I want a divorce. Because it'd been, we'd been apart for 30 days at least. And so I said, I don't want a divorce. I need to go to somewhere where somebody understands me, somebody who understands my heart, who doesn't judge me, where I can feel comfortable. I need to go to an AA meeting. So that's what I did. And that was the greatest blessing, to retreat from an uncomfortable situation to an AA meeting where I felt comfortable. And so the journey began there, and it progressed then because of the other bar. I got involved with the other bar because I wanted more than AA had for me. This is just me. I wanted more. I wanted to reconnect. And I was a pariah in the bar association now. I would walk to this side of the room and you would all go to that side. And I would walk to that side and you would all come to this side. Because I was a felon, man. I was in the papers. I was an unknown quantity. I had disgraced people and professions, So it was not good. So I wanted more. I wanted to reconnect. And I had heard about this other bar. And there wasn't another bar in our area that was active, and so we started one. And I got connected with a couple of people, and we started another bar in our area. And Carol Wynn was one of the guys who would come out to our other bar meeting in Bloomington, California, and taught us how to conduct these meetings and how to be a part of the other bar and how to meld this with AA and connect it and to be available to others who need to be a part of. And then through the other bar, I met Ted C. And Ted C got me involved with the statewide other bar. And Ted C took me to, or introduced me to Boston. And I went to the ILAA in Boston and saw an even greater cast of characters, that were in recovery. Man, these are amazing people. These are Supreme Court justices and big time partners and law school deans and professors and litigators and good achievement oriented, accomplished people who seem to be living their lives on an even plane, who seem happy and satisfied and serene and comfortable with each other and with themselves. And so I learned about you, and you taught me. And so then, after that, I started writing some things for the other bar about recovery, and they went into local legal papers and that sort of thing, and we progressed then into those other things that I told you about, to the county bar president. Now, can you imagine the pariah being accepted? And then to the state bar board of governors, where I was the governor over five or six counties, and then to the state bar presidency, where I had the Supreme Court Chief Justice's cell phone in my pocket, and all the connections that you could ever imagine. What a wonderful, wonderful life. And I had my wife back, and we've never been separated, and so for 42 years, and I had those boys back, and the boys that couldn't understand who that guy was that was drunk telling them how much he loved them, and who was, you know, on their case, and it was that same old jerk that was in the easy chair with the Hams beer in his hand was who I was. And so you have changed my life. You have brought me back. And so, whenever I hear the song Amazing Grace, I cry. And I cry because of the grace of God through you has brought me the miracle. Thank you.